Welcome to the Rugby Bits podcast brought to you by bet.co.za. Thank you for listening to wherever you listen to your podcast. Please share the podcast as much as possible. Subscribe, like, give us a five-star rating in whatever podcast platform that you use so we can share this podcast with the rugby world. Please also visit the bet.co.za website for all the interesting markets that they have in the Six Nations. And hopefully after this chat, you'll be more looking into some of the England teams and the England players as well. My name is Tyler Msutu, and I'm joined from the Rugby Bits squad by Sean today. And then we have a special guest who we're going to go into a bit more detail into England rugby and how they're going in this year's Six Nations and in preparation for the 2023 World Cup. Charlie Morgan is our guest today. He's the senior rugby writer at the Daily Telegraph. And if you follow him, you'll see he does a lot of good sort of like breakdowns about plays and just patterns as well. So Charlie, welcome to the Rugby Bits pod.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think just to jump straight into it, and we were discussing it a little bit before now, it does seem like England has started to make a shift with their attacking game plan, especially in the last few months, from what they were doing before in last year's Six Nations, and they started getting going with it in November, and now they're trying to continue with it now. And it's sort of this positionless almost rugby that Eddie Jones has been talking about, that he wants to move away from sort of the 1-3-3-1 or 2-4-2 formations into something that's a bit more everyone can just jump in, act as the scrum half, and act as a first receiver as well. So, yeah, I think the first step or the first thing we can ask is the why. And is it more because someone like Marcus Smith has come into the team, or is it Eddie trying to be a step ahead before the 2023 World Cup?
I think everything that Eddie Jones does with this England team, and it's a reason that it frustrates some supporters, which we'll come on to later, is framed by World Cup. I think he's, as far as, if you look at the international coaches around the world, he's probably the most unapologetic and explicit about framing things by World Cup cycles. And we can sort of talk about how South Africa, I think, changed the game by winning the last World Cup on the back of what was essentially 18 months of sort of intense of getting those cohesion and combinations and clarity and all of that right. So it's potentially changed a little bit, but this attacking kind of development is part of this next stage for him, I think, and looking towards 2023. And if you think about the World Cup cycle we're in as a whole, 2020 for England was about consolidating and making sure that the final defeat to the Springboks didn't affect them, I think. It was about making sure that they didn't slide into a spiral of defeats. And I think if you watch their they've got a really good YouTube series going on at the minute, but one of the really interesting episodes straight after that final, for the 2026 Nations, there was a presentation that Owen Farrell was giving, and behind him there was a list of the winning percentages of losing finalists previously, and they were pretty low. They were sort of 50%, because I guess that sort of result and that experience can take a real psychological toll and really kind of damage a side's development. And England were desperate to not to do that. And they thought the best way of doing that was sort of a kick heavy, relying on their defense, which they did throughout 2020 and won two trophies doing that. But where that left them in 2021 was with a group of players that Jones felt he needed refreshing. So he felt like he needed a new spine. And then the new attacks has come sort of on the back of those new players as well. So to answer your question in a lot fewer words, it's a bit of both, I think. It's a bit of the personnel that he wants to blood. And then also the fact that he feels that England need to develop a lot as far as their attacking repertoire to go deep in 2023.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting just how this it's sort of been built, that England's trying to build up towards 2023, because of course in 2021 Six Nations it was one of England's worst performances, I think, and probably in the most recent history. And it was quite clear there that it seems like Eddie Jones made a transition in saying that's the end of the road for some of the players, you know, the Vodipolas, to an extent someone like George Ford and Elliot Daly as well, and trying to bring in new players. He started with the games against the United States in July, and in the November series as well. So I think just looking back a little bit, is there a way for maybe the likes of the Vinipolas, especially, I think, to come back into this team, or is the door fully shut?
So it's interesting you use the door analogy. That's exactly what Jones uses as well. He says the door's never shut. So I know whether or not that's, I don't think it's as shut for them as it is for somebody like Alex Lazowski, for instance, who we saw once in 2018 and then he's never sort of made his way back. I think ironically, what England would have been really, would have really benefited England in their first three games of the Six Nations would have been a real kind of fit and firing Bulle Vunipola to sort of dominate that game line a bit more. I think with Ford's a really interesting one. He's obviously back in the fold at the minute after the injury to Farrell. And he was an unused sub against Wales, which was kind of a little bit kind of eye-catching, really, given that he'd come on in that first game against Scotland. I think the way this cycle's gone again, to go back to that, is that he now has these really experienced players that can come in and slot in. And it might be that Ford was initially excluded. It was my reading of it, that he wanted to give Marcus Smith the reins and have Owen Farrell there as sort of a conduit at inside centre and to have that experience to lean on. But having another fly half in that squad would have potentially been a bit claustrophobic for Smith. So I think that was the thinking there. So I think, again, it is, those guys are there now, and they have, you know, however many, all of those three guys, both Vunipolas and Ford, have upwards of 50 caps. Ford's got a lot more than that. I'm not sure that, I think the other guys are sort of 60 and 70 around that mark. You know, those are the players that can come in and sort of figure it out. They're clever enough rugby players to figure out this new way of playing and what their role within that would be. But at the moment, I think how they play is maybe slightly too jarring to what England wants. So for instance, we're going to get into it later. So for eight, Alex Donbrandt, Jones feels as though he's the guy that is going to give England a higher ceiling within this kind of philosophy. So that's the way he's gone. Loosehead, they've got Genge and they've got Marler, and Bevan Rodd is this young guy who's a really good ball player, really mobile. So that's the way they're going there. I do think it's just the way it's worked out, is that these very experienced players, because they played a lot of rugby early on in their careers, so they're not finished, but they're still there if they need to be called upon.
I think it's important, you know, just listening to you and what you had to say, and I mean, we pretty much picked up a hell of a lot of that in terms of the balance and what they want to do and how we see Eddie Jones unrolling what he wants. I think the big thing is there was a clear move in the pack to make some changes, and the unfortunate part of that, coupled with Manatu Lagi and Owen Farrell being out, and I think that and that's exactly the Bulle Vunipola is something that I picked up was missing. They were missing. I even mentioned Nathan Hughes. I mean, he only had played one game back for Bath, but that kind of a player, because you weren't getting it with Slade at 12, and I love Slade. Like, I think he's great. I mean, he can play 10, 12, 13, 15, 11, 14, anyway, you know? And the thing is, but there was no one there, and Marcus Smith needs that. He absolutely needs that. And it was so clear when him and Farrell are playing. Farrell's taking a lot of stuff up, and then Smith is getting broken field and just weaving magic. Just a quick one in terms of the size and getting that go-forward ball. Do you think that Freddie Stewart is unused in that, or they're trying to let him settle at 15? Because he's a big unit. Like, could they not have tried to change that up a little bit? That was the first part. And the second part, again, I'm a huge fan of Daly, but I would prefer to have seen Marchant at 13. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with both of your points. Stewart is a... If we're talking about this new spine to England, I think Stewart has established himself almost more than Marcus Smith has, as far as that very first bolt on of that. I think he's everybody sort of kind of following him coming through the ranks at Leicester. he just looked so impressive every step up he took. So in Premiership games, when Leicester were getting pumped, he still looked pretty classy. He looked good when in the Champions Cup games. And then so this kind of introduction to Test rugby has looked really assured and pretty seamless from that regard. I think the next stage for him, I think against Wales, you showed, I know that the back three have come in for a little bit of criticism over potentially lacking a bit of pace and maybe, but I just think how important his security was. When England have played Wales in the past, they've given Wales ways in because they haven't been as secure aerially, and Stewart dropped one ball, I think. Apart from that, he was flawless, and he was generating momentum off those kick returns. What we did see, Sean, and it's really interesting you make that point, we did see him coming off Marcus Smith's shoulder in phase play once or twice, so very small, which suggests to me that that's something that he's being asked to do. That would make sense and maybe mitigate kind of a lack of that thrust in the centre. Having said that, I've felt throughout that Slade's the best way to balance that midfield from the players that they've got, and I don't count Manu Tuilagi in that, is a Slade Marchant combination, which is obviously the combination that they had for most of that South Africa game. And it wouldn't have cut apart the best midfield in the world had it not been balanced and had they not had that threat of Marchant going hard at the line, which obviously he got the ball once. He didn't get the ball for in the first half when the Slade's pass went directly to Stewart. He didn't get the ball, but he did hold South Africa narrow, didn't he? So that's why I feel it's balanced. And that's actually, and again, you make the point there, you touched on it yourself, that I don't think Marcus Smith is actually being given the tools to fully settle at the minute. And I think he's being hamstrung. And I think actually it's more impressive what he's doing because he isn't being given that infrastructure around him, really. But Slade's a really interesting point, and just kind of make one more point in this big ramble. But his role at 12 as that first receiver has just become so central to what England is doing that it's almost clouded the rest of the balance of the midfield, I think. So England's line-out strikes are so important to them. And Slade took on that role of first receiver in the autumn when he had Manu Tuilagi outside of him. And that was great. But when Manu Tuilagi's gone, not having that ball runner has kind of caused England to have to call shortened line-outs with Ellis Genge and Don Brandt and Simmons and Curry. They've all tried to kind of make up these things in different ways. And Stewart, him coming into phase play, is another way that they're kind of making up for the fact that they haven't just got that gritty, tougher runner in midfield. Because Scotland and Wales, Scotland's try through Ben White with that 11 play going up through Sean, I've forgotten his name, that's terrible. The Scotland inside centre just hitting up. Johnson, yeah, hitting up just a short line, getting momentum, then bouncing back to the blind side. And then in the build-up to Nick Tompkins' try, again, first phase line out, Nick Tompkins between Smith and Slade, momentum again, and they found space out wide, grubbered, won that 5-metre line out. That's a, you know, and you're going to have Aki, Henshaw, these guys queuing up because that's a glaring area of weakness for England at the minute.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a good place to start with this conversation about the England backline and sort of moving in almost a post Tuilagi world, because I mean, I think a lot of people have said how this reliance that England has on Tuilagi is just it's almost debilitating because there's just no one else that seems like in England rugby that can fill that gap. If only Andre Esterhazy had an English grandmother, I think Odie Jones is thinking right now. But
No. You calm your palm.
It just doesn't seem like there is any player in the Premiership that has that sort of similar skill set to a Tuilagi or Esterhazy or Dielander or anyone like that. And I mean, it's quite interesting that Eddie hasn't really used this either the November test or the test now to even try someone like Atkinson, who's, I mean, maybe has a bit of a limited ceiling in international rugby, or to fully commit to Joe Marchant being the centre partner for someone like Slade. is it just a matter of they just will never be as good as someone like Manu in terms of just drawing defenders and hitting up in the middle? Or, yeah, is it just Eddie just trying to stick with what he knows? Because it seemed like he was sort of moving towards that. And then once Farrell also went out, I mean, and you count the other injuries to someone like Johnny May and Anthony Watson as well, there was so much experience taken away from the England team that I think Elliot Daly was used as almost like a security blanket just to make sure there isn't too many rookies. Because I think without Daly, then it would basically be just Youngs and Slay that have over like 15 caps in that England backline as options.
Yeah, totally. I think there was a bit of kind of balancing the side from a experience point of view and not wanting. There are so many. Again, it's a point that both of you guys have touched on. There are so many moving parts to this rebuild almost that some constants as far as experience had to stay. And I think that the side that started against Scotland, that was influenced by Joe Marchant having COVID for a start. And I think actually that the team that they named for Wales, so we did have Slade Marchant against Italy. And then against Wales, I think with Tuilagi back, the plan had been obviously to have Daly was on the bench, wasn't he, originally 23. Yes. So obviously he's having started one game at centre, he's, you know, worst case scenario covering an injury to 12 as well. So whichever way they would have gone. Sorry, they would have Tuilagi would have stayed there and Daly would have gone to 13, but he's covering 13 as well. So that's what it was, sort of Daly's versatility, a bit of kind of circumstances with Marchant being injured and ill. I'd expect them to go back to Slade Marchant for Ireland just because of that balance is there. But to answer your question, I think Mark Atkinson, there's maybe that feeling that's his ceiling. There's also the point that he is fulfilling the same role for Gloucester as Slade is for England now with that shape. He's that first receiver. Yeah. So it's kind of, although Smith, Atkinson, Slade has quite a nice balance to it, it would also mean that Slade would be hitting those hard lines. And I don't think he's at test level particularly compelling and particularly effective at that. That would be a sort of round peg, square hole situation. He's probably the best. There's probably better sticking off with that ball player and then using his left foot off at second receiver, as we saw for that 50-22 against Wales. So I think it's been a case of trying to balance what he's got. And I actually think, you know, it was quite poignant that Nick Tompkins did score that try because, you know, he's a guy that's come through the England age group. I think won a Junior World Cup for England in the 20s, and he's just a tough runner, punches above his weight, doesn't win every battle, but to use a Razzieism, gets into millions of them over the 80 minutes. And I think England sort of, they are missing a sort of uncomplicated 12 like that. They've got somebody, Dan Kelly's coming through at Leicester, who looks very good. Max Ajomo is a bit more of a ball player maybe than Kelly. Two really interesting options who are in the squad for the summer. So the players are there. I think what they'll do for the rest of the Six Nations is continue with Slade Marchant. I think the midfield options for the tour of Australia will be really telling. But again, as I say, I don't think Jones is in a rush for any of this because his paymasters at the RFU are totally fine with him framing his tenure by World Cups. So, you know, unless something goes disastrously wrong against Ireland and France, and that could happen, then I think he'll be given the time to get that right and just to cycle through a few more options.
Yeah, I don't think I made a bit of a bold statement before the Six Nations and saying even if he went on to lose every game until the World Cup, he'd still be the coach. I really don't think that he'll go unless something crazy happens, and I don't think it'll be a result. I think it'll be something where he tells someone to go jump as opposed to poor work performance. But I think with his numberless backline, also because he's got inverted commas, but he's got the big players and he's got the guys. And the thing is he really does have so many players to reach his hand into the pot and pull out if need be. But there are a couple of bigger guys. I mean, so obviously, I've forgotten. Left wing, Chiefs, for England.
Jack Noll.
Yes, sorry. Noll's a big, hard carrier as well. Kokonasiga's just come back, but I don't think he's going to be massively in the running. But he could fill a gap, even though it's his first game back. He did score two tries, but he's a massive, massive unit. And then, you know, I think that's the thing. I think when Jones turns around and goes numberless backline, I think he essentially means he's going to have a massive ball carrier somewhere, which is going to draw someone, and then there'll be a gap.
Yeah, totally. I feel like I've accidentally sent you my notes for this. I've got these things written down. The Noel actually, I spoke to, so he was up for media today, and I actually asked him about whether he had to carry more in the absence of Tuilagi, and he was kind of a bit non-committal, didn't really answer it, but he said that, you know, what this new philosophy of attack means to him is that just he's just got freedom to pick up a load of touches in and around kind of the rucks and things like that. And you've seen that. That's been a big feature. So a big thing, one thing we haven't mentioned at the minute, sorry, is that England obviously got a new backs coach just before those two games in the summer. So that's been a big part of this, a big kind of spur for this change as well. And we've seen one trend of how England are attacking under Gleeson, under Martin Gleeson, is for those wings to kind of almost pendulum across to the opposite 15-meter line. Nothing new, and actually Exeter have been doing it for a long time. But Noel really suits Noel and really gives him that opportunity to add a bit of thrust. But yeah, no, that's totally spot on. I think what this numberless thing means is just that he's going straight to, so coaches now are talking about messy and unpredictable attack. And that's what Ireland is, kind of the end game for Ireland. But they started with this 1-3-2-2, didn't they? Sort of using a bit of what Japan did to them. England have sort of, I think, gone about it trying to go straight to the end game of being unpredictable and messy. And I just think that is just going to take a lot of time. Whether it ends up working, I'm not sure, but it's going to be fun to watch them try.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I think to do that almost like ultra attack, everyone can play thing. I mean, just looking at how Ireland are being successful so far is they have players from 1 to 23 that can run, pass, ruck, yeah, as effectively as anyone. And I think England is sort of getting there, but you can see, I think maybe, and we haven't really mentioned them too much in sort of this conversation yet, the importance of someone like Owen Farrell, I think, just to balance everything. And even if maybe Tuilagi is not available, someone like Farrell does, maybe not, he's obviously not the best or the biggest ball carrier in the world, but he's able to come in and he's able to make that impact and is able to hold the line. And he can sort of balance the thing between the two sort of like approaches of having, you know, a set sort of like fly half to play off of, and, you know, having runners just all around. So I think the question that I have, and sort of the ultimate sort of place that I think we're all trying to find out, and I'm sure, I don't know if you know what the answer is, but we can try to sort of figure it out here. But what then is England's ultimate backline if and when everyone is fit? Like, you know, it almost seems like Slade, Farrell, and Smith, there's probably only place for two of them. If you also want Manu in the backline too, or do you put Manu in the wing like you did in November? The only people that seem to be quite assured of their places is Ben Youngs being one of either the starting or the reserve scrum half. Freddie Stewart probably is almost assured of fullback, and the other places have some form of sort of debatability as to who can come in and who plays what role. So yeah, what do you think is sort of the ultimate sort of England backline, and do you think it includes maybe some a Tuilagi or a Marchand playing off the wing and sort of coming into the centres and set plays and all the fancy stuff he was trying to do against the Wallabies and the Springboks? Because I think, I mean, it's quite clear that they prepared for the box.
I think if you work backwards, I think eventually Slade, Daly and Maylands, those three, to have those three guys, I think if we look back in a year or so, I think it might seem a bit odd that those three were both have been in the same starting side, because they can sort of fulfill a very similar role within a side, given, you know, what their sort of attributes are. I would say, and again, there's this disconnect between what an ideal backline is and what it is going to be, because you're potentially relying on players that aren't haven't got the kind of best track record as far as keeping fit. But so you've got players like, I think he'll want at least one of May or Watson. I think he'll want at least one of Noel and Thokonosinga as well. And I think obviously Tuilagi comes into that. And then I think it's probably two of Smith, Slade and Farrell. I think my guess would be something like, I think this is kind of my opinion, I think I'm surprised that they've gone with Randall over Quirk, because I think Quirk is a sort of more rounded player. So I think, again, this is, you know, rugby's about this, right? It's game of opinions. And so I'd go, as you say, whichever one starts, Young's going to be there. So if we say Quirk 9, Smith 10, Farrell 12, Tuilagi 13, Thokonosinga right wing, and then probably Watson maybe. I think he does really like Watson, I think, and then Stewart fullback. And I think you've got what you'd have then is players like Maylands, Slade and Daly, who are perfect for that 23 slot if it ends up a 6-2 split on the bench. But there's going to be some very good players missing out on the World Cup squad entirely, let alone the 15 and the 23. As far as the different types of players, if you list all of them, and I've sort of very helpfully sat on the fence by listing just about every back in England there, but there's different profiles of player, aren't there? So there's at least two per different profile of player. So, and kind of we've touched on cohesion a few times and how England look to build that. There are two different ways of doing that. Three different ways, I guess. They tap into players that have played together quite a lot at club level. So that'd be Don Brandt and Smith. They tap into players that have played a lot at test level. So obviously that's how Ford and Farrell work. But then the other way to do that is obviously to introduce new combinations. And the Smith-Slade axis is something that is a kind of Jones creation. And that is something now that he's invested a lot of time in, out of circumstance, obviously, because I don't think they'd have played that much together if Farrell had been available. But Farrell's missed now. If you take two tests in the summer, three in the autumn, he's played in one of the last eight now. So that's a lot of time he's missed as far as building towards 2023. I'm certain that he'll be at the World Cup, and I'm certain that he'll be pushing hard for that place in the starting side. But I think given the amount of time that Jones has invested in Smith-Slade too, it will be a really big decision to make if Tuilagi is also fit. But we know that that's not a given.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting. And maybe Farrell as a finisher just coming off the bench, like that's also a very interesting prospect as well. I mean, you know, 100 plus caps, just coming on to do whatever you need to do in a game. And he can play with Smith or with Slade, so he can sort of come into both roles. Yeah, I think sort of my personal thing is definitely that there must be, you build around Farrell, but you can just see how many other different options that you can take here, and maybe it can be a bit more of a horses for courses type selection as well.
Yeah.
Just one quick sort of sidebar. I know it's something that you've been talking about a little bit and you've been asked about as well, and something I think you are, I don't know if it's tongue-in-cheek or not, but pushing for Sam Simmons and Alfie Barbary to come into the midfield. Yeah, I think it's obviously an interesting option for many reasons, but maybe especially just like off phase play, them coming in to come crash into the game. But yeah, Barbary just seems to be that player that could be sort of another new person that comes in like in the next year or so and can we will sort of blink and he'll be in the match 23 in a World Cup knockout game. He's just, yeah, he's a very sort of interesting sort of talent. And obviously the fact that he can play two or three positions, or he's played two or three positions now in senior rugby is quite interesting. So, yeah, are Simmons and Barbary also in that center depth chart for you? Or is it more tongue-in-cheek?
They're not. No, it was just an article that we got, one of our readers sort of asked. And it was one of those things where you generally dismiss it, don't you? You go, oh, that couldn't possibly happen, that position switch. But I actually got to thinking, you know, I'm to be fair, I'm just saying that. I'm not, you know, I haven't tried to convert a player previously. I don't know what work that takes. So I asked Ali Hefer, who's Sam Simmons' coach at Exeter, said, well, you know, what would that entail? And to be fair, at Exeter, it would be unpicking the entire way that they've balanced the pack and the entire way that they've balanced the recruitment of their pack, because they essentially pick four locks or four very, very big men to make sure that they give Sam Simmons go forward, and that they do a lot of those really those carries in heavy traffic for him, and he's freed up to do what he does best. Obviously, there's probably just too much going on to make that shift into a permanent one. Barbary would be a better bet just because he's younger and he's had that at schoolboy level. He played at 12. I think he's put on a fair bit of timber since then. He's looking leaner recently, but I think again it would be a fairly big deal for that drastic switch when he's just kind of concentrated on the back row over hooker. But as you say, it's first phase stuff that they've been using back rows. They've been using Curry, Simmons, Genge and Dombrandt in those kind of just off those starter plays to give them a bit of go forward. But that's more a kind of, yeah, that's more a kind of reflection on, you know, on what they don't have in the midfield at the moment or what they aren't picking. So yeah, that's just how they're trying to move their resources around, I guess.
And yeah, is there like maybe someone that maybe from outside as South African fans we maybe aren't aware of, is there maybe a bolter for like the England team or match 23 that you can think of that maybe it's just starting to enter into the squad, or yeah, maybe he's not even in the squad right now that you think could make it in a year's time? Sorry, I know I think I've put you on a spot.
So Alfie Barbary would be the main one, but I think everybody in the world's aware of him. I actually, again, feel like I've accidentally sent you my notes that I'd written when you said what's on his checklist to sort out before 2023. I said I've put give Alfie Barbary 10 caps. Just a magic up 10 caps for him would be very useful out of the World Cup. Somebody that's just been in the squad recently, actually, who's really come from left field, is a guy called Tom Pearson, who's just come training. He's from London Irish, but actually he's another guy who's not being with a professional club academy, but he's played a lot in the university stuff for Cardiff Met. So at the same place that Alex Dombrandt and Luke Northmore, the Harlequin centre, played. Just really actually looks like a little bit like Jack Willis, as far as like he's quite a rangy back rower who's really good at the breakdown, and gets in a lot of those in transitions really dangerous because he's just got this really big loping sort of stride, and he's quite quick over the ground. So yeah, another really fun back row, and he's really been sort of, This is it with Jones. Like, you can't really say, I'll give you the chance, because sometimes he just pulls these guys in out of absolutely nowhere. And in this guy, Tom Pearson is one of these guys. I think otherwise you could look where these a lot of these players end up in the back row, or sort of they end up being back rowers, these really young bolters, just because that's the nature of it. These really talented players coming through, that's where they're coming through. Someone like Tom Willis, Jack's brother at Wasps, number eight, really good carrier, looking really good too. So yeah, I'll probably think of a couple now when we're speaking about something else, but those have been with Barbary sort of heading it, but everybody's heard of him.
I think, yeah, we can maybe start sort of rounding up on this point, sort of what's the key points that Eddie will like to sort of tick off before the World Cup. And we were talking also before the recording about sort of how you know, I think what happened with South Africa in the 2019 World Cup has maybe changed the script for people that, you know, you can take a team that was literally like, what, seventh, eighth in the world and make them a world champion in 2 years. So there isn't necessarily that need to do things out of 4 years and all that sort of stuff. And your best players, especially like if you look at the South African example, like the likes of Amon Mapimpi had less than 20 caps, test caps, and were world champions. So sort of in that sort of context, and, you know, just trying to plan now with, you know, two more Six Nations matches, a tour to Australia, and then, you know, the November test and then another Six Nations to go, like what is Eddie going to be trying to be doing in the next few years?
God, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it, when you frame it like that. Two more games to finish the Six Nations, two very big ones, three games in Australia that will be fascinating, and then those autumns, another Six Nations, then you're into the warm-ups, it's nuts. But yeah, no, it's going to come around very quickly, and as I say, Jones has just been totally empowered to work towards the World Cup as that being the be-all and end-all almost, and that kind of puts some fans' noses out of joint. That would be, I know that the kind of criticism that Jones gets kind of, sometimes can look for quite strange from the outside, but I'd say that is sometimes a big reason for it, is that framing of everything with the World Cup in mind can maybe look like he's not giving the present enough thought. And I don't think that's true, but I think that's potentially how it looks like. I think someone like Alfie Barbary, if we're talking about World Cup bolters that could change the look and feel of the side, I'd say Alfie Barbary was one of them, just as far as how he's intuitive. He's just a super aggressive carrier as well. And those two things potentially England have lacked a bit. If we're looking at their performances so far, this Six Nations, again, this is an opinion thing, but I imagine that Quirk will come into the running at scrum half. I just think he's too good not to. There's just so many things that he's doing in the Premiership that's reminding me of how Faf de Klerk sort of energises sides.
Yes.
Just as far as how he's taking on a really that free defensive role, he's fantastic at. Looks really, really good. And that's obviously just a way to really enhance a defensive side that would be great for England. He'll hope that at least one of Dokuna Singa or Tuilagi are fit for that. I don't know how he manages that over time. I think maybe he just says to them, look, all you need to do for me is to be fit for those warm-up games before the tournament. Because I think South Africa rewrote the script on how to get ready for a World Cup and kind of made sure that it didn't have to be this gradual thing. It could be really quick if you get the right players. I think England's teaming together of Sam Underhill and Tom Curry was actually a huge component in their team, and that happened really, really late.
Yeah.
That was only the warm-ups that happened, and it was sort of when that did happen, it was like, wow, okay. That's a game changer. That's potentially, I think maybe those two things together go to show that if you come into the tournament with something slightly unpredictable and something that isn't settled and hasn't been poured over by analysts, then maybe that's a route that's going to give you a bit of energy and a bit of a sense of the unknown that's really valuable. Because I know for a fact that, you know, Ireland are cooking at the minute, and I know they went down to France, but they've put together a lot of really, really nice stuff. I know there certainly will be a little bit of nervousness that, yikes, you know, we've still got a long time to go here before the World Cup, and we don't want to be peaking too early again because they've done that before. So I think it's a gradual thing, and I think the thing with England, as we've said a few times on this podcast, is that the players are there, few of them are injured. So they will all be available, and they are good and experienced enough to slot into the foundations of what is going on now. And I think that's what is hopeful for England. Having said all that, I think the way their progress is perceived is on a knife edge a bit, because, you know, two underwhelming performances in these last two games of the Six Nations could mean another fourth or fifth place finish. That just looks horrible. And the thing is, you can't really say that they're a better side than that, because actually their performance against Wales, speaking to the players sort of today, they were sort of saying, look, yeah, we feel like we left a few opportunities out there. We feel like could have been 25 points up in the first half. They weren't. And in fairness, the game as a whole was probably a reflection of the progress that they've got through at the minute. So it can't. I don't think it's really unfair to say that that's probably where they are right now. There's a long way to go, but there is. Although we've just said, you know, there are a few games, and you can almost, what is it, one tour, about what, four campaigns to go, if that, yeah. And that will go quickly. But that a lot can happen in that time too.
Yeah, I think it's a complex picture, and I think maybe I think as South Africans we maybe don't quite get the pressure from the sort of the England public. And of course, I think the first thing is because of how important the Six Nations is. You know, I think there's a lot of pride in that, you know, England and other countries' fans don't want to be, you know, in that bottom half of the table and want to get hopefully at least 3 wins out of 5 just to show that they're as strong as the other team. So when that doesn't happen, that already puts a lot of pressure on a coach. And yeah, I think in South Africa, maybe our perspective is a little bit different. Maybe it's also because we always get pumped by the All Blacks in the Rugby Championship. But, you know, we could take that for a whole World Cup cycle and then win the World Cup at the end and be fine with it. I mean, that's literally what we've had to do for most of our World Cup wins. And yeah, it's quite interesting just seeing the different perspective from the England public about that.
That was a really fantastic point, that first one you made about the Six Nations. And if you think about that, manifests itself in how quickly the narratives swing. So for instance, England were pretty good, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10, I thought, for 3/4 of that first game against Scotland, just in the context of everything, of having just come together, having playing a Scotland side on the up, away at Murrayfield in pretty crap conditions. And yet, you know, they built that 7-point lead, brought on those experienced players to see out the game. A lot of that was right. And then everything has turned on its head. The narrative is totally turned on its head with, you know, a bizarre end to the game. And because these games are infrequent and because they mean a hell of a lot, that colours the narrative of how we view England's progress. And that's a really, really good point. And it is something that fans invest a lot of pride in. So therefore, you know, they're really not going to be particularly forgiving for another kind of underwhelming Six Nations campaign as a whole.
But I think we'll round up there. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, I think it was just a great insight about what's happening in England and like sort of the build up for this. And yeah, I think it's England's, I think, quite similar to South Africa, where a loss can sometimes be is a lot more dramatic than it needs to be. And sometimes a win is also a bit over dramatized as well. And everyone is the best player in the world, but then when they lose, everyone needs to be fired. But yeah, it seems that it's still a very scary prospect because of just there's 30, 40 players that you can call upon that are potential world-class players in the England team.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it. Just over drama. Melodrama the whole way.
But thank you so much, Charlie, for your insight. Please follow him at Charlie Felix on Twitter as well. And pretty much every week, right? You have like some sort of like breakdown analysis of the game.
Yeah, I'll be posting all the links on there just to bore everybody.
Perfect. No, it's great. It's great content, especially if you're trying to see like what attacking structures England or some of the teams in the Premiership are running. And yeah, hopefully, yeah, we can also have you back sometime to talk Premiership stuff as well. There's, I think with Quins and obviously a lot of the South African interest in like, you know, Tigers and all that sort of stuff, there's a lot to talk about there. And yeah, thanks so much, Sean, also for joining.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
And yeah, I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much for everyone for listening. This is the Rugby Bits pod. Please come to our, also visit our website as well for, you know, articles that we're writing about the game. And please also visit the bet.co.za website, who are our proud sponsors of the Rugby Bits pod, for all the markets that they have for the Six Nations and some of the odds still there. I mean, England is still in the race to win the Six Nations. Believe it or not, it might have sounded so depressing now about like where they are and all that sort of stuff in 2022, but they could still win it if they beat Ireland and France. And thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for listening. Please, again, like, share, subscribe to the podcast as well. We're trying to hopefully infiltrate the United Kingdom market as well. And we will see you next time. Goodbye.